Luckily, Cryptids and Critters is intended for mature audiences. Many of our topics may involve violent, sexual, or otherwise heavy themes that may be difficult for some listeners.
Welcome to Luckily Cryptids and Critters, a podcast where we discuss various cryptids, monsters, and things that go bump in the night.
I'm Loki Lee, your resident armchair anthropologist and Scandinavian scholar.
And I'm Lee, your resident redneck and wannabe historian of Slavic and paranormal folklore.
Alright, so today we are talking about witches, and this is our part one episode on witches. We are doing witches in Mesoamerica and specifically the Nordic Viking Age. So how much do you know about witches in either of these areas, Lee?
I know a tiny little bit about Nordic myths involving witches that are almost witches in the way that like Greek figures are witches, like Circe in the Odyssey, almost like minor godlike figures, and that's about as far as I get. Like, I think Freya comes to mind. I may be way off on that as well. I may be completely wrong.
Okay.
Mesoamerica. I know they are called brujas or brujos for the masculine feminine conjunction. Most of what I know about them would come from True Blood and the Paranormal Activity film franchise. So I'm going to go ahead and say 99.9% of what I think I know about them is inaccurate.
Okay. You're right. In Mesoamerica, they are bruja or brujo. The act of witchcraft is called brujería, and they have a connection to owls, particularly white owls, probably barn owls. There is the story of La Lechuza, which literally translates to the owl, and she's a witch who has the ability to transform into animals such as owls or crows.
Okay, what makes a bruja or a brujo have a particular connection to the owl as an animal? Is it just because this folktale involves a witch who has the ability to turn into an owl, and that becomes attached to all witches, warlocks in the tradition, or is there something else there that connects the animals to them?
I think it's just because if you look at barn owls, they're very kind of spooky looking. They look like little aliens. Their faces are all kind of weird. They're a little bit scary.
Owls are strange little creatures, yeah, for sure.
They can get pretty big, and you can see them pretty starkly against the night sky. So I think that's why.
Are owls particularly common in Central America?
I believe so. Yeah.
I know you got quite a few different species in the American Southwest. My favorite are the burrowing owls, the little fat ones on the ground.
They're very cute.
Okay. Continue, please. Sorry.
As far as like a social reason for why witches are so prevalent, it usually validates explanations for unknown chronic illnesses, death with unknown causes, streaks of bad luck. It's an outlet for hatred and resentment, meaning that it gives the collective society a place to direct their anger at various different things that have gone wrong in their lives, as opposed to just directing that anger or resentment towards a specific person who you think might have done you wrong, but you don't know. It directs it towards witches and makes you feel a little righteous in your anger. It reduces anxiety from cognitive dissonance. So like if somebody dies from an unknown cause and you're not sure what it is, maybe it's a plague and you get really anxious about that, And you can direct that anxiety at, oh no, this was witchcraft. This was bad magic. This is what happened. And it gives you an explanation for not being able to figure out why something went wrong or why somebody may have died unexpectedly.
Now, see, this is good. This will come up in part two. We'll get into it more there, but I want to touch on it briefly here. The things you're describing about, like, ways to explain chronic illness or, you know, the meaningless traumas and horrible events that happen to all of us in our lives and families, a way to make sense of those and explain those and channel that energy. I want to ask a question based on that sort of idea, which is, what is the understanding of these individuals within Mesoamerican culture? Are they essential parts of a community? Are they outsiders of that community? Are they respected elders in the community? Are they to be avoided? And, like, where does their power, I guess, come from? What gives them the ability to do these supernatural actions that they take?
That I had difficulties finding, like, what exactly gives them the ability to do this. I imagine it relates back to ancient Maya or Aztec gods and legends.
Sure, so it comes from the indigenous culture and it gets colored over time by
European colonialism,
The Catholic influences and everything.
Yeah, I believe now people believe the magic comes from the saints. And as to what role they play in the community, it's a little bit of both outsider and, how do I want to put this? A little bit of outsider and revered healer. People who are midwives or healers are often known as bruja or brujo. You know that you can go to them for various different things. Like if you get sick unknowingly, if you get hurt somehow, you can get a poultice from them. If you need to attract a specific lover, then you can go to them and get some love magic.
Right, so there's like a moral ambivalence there, right? Like you could contract a bruja to curse your ex-boyfriend and his family, or you could contract a bruja to entice your next boyfriend to fall in love with you, right?
Yep.
So then my next question that I kind of have a reference for based on other media that I've consumed is how popular is brujeria in Mesoamerican culture? Now, let me preface that with saying we may talk about this more in the pop culture segment, but one of the things I know is any film about Mexican drug cartels or Colombian drug cartels will always shoehorn a little bit about how Mexican cartel leaders practice some type of blood witchcraft to worship a patron saint of death or something, and how it involves black magic. That's sort of a trashy cliche way of putting it, but based on what I've heard before, I have a suspicion that this practice is a lot more widespread than just to, like, the criminal element, right?
Yeah, I imagine having the drug cartels linked to witchcraft is one of the things that reduces anxiety from cognitive dissonance. People have a hard time figuring out why someone would want to specifically hurt others. And so, oh, well, there must be witchcraft involved. That's why they're like this. They have decided to take a dark path, and that's the reason why they're so powerful, is because of witchcraft. But definitely there are witches and healers who are members of the community and take care of the community. Like if you're looking for some healing, you can go to a curandero. They are healers in the community. You don't like go around and put up a shingle and say, like, yes, I am the curandero in this area. It is something that is bestowed upon by the community. You're a person that everybody knows they can go to for healing or midwifery or general, like, love spells, good luck spells, things like that. It's definitely still somewhat common. I feel like it makes a lot of sense to continue to be common. There's a lot of cognitive dissonance happening in that area of the world right now between the drug cartels and the fascist governments that are trying to take rise. There's a whole lot of people, like normal people like you and me, just trying to make it through their lives and need all the help they can get. So you go to a curandero and try to get some luck, or some, maybe get some love magic to attract a rich partner or a caring partner or something like that.
All right, this leads me to another question, which is, would you go to the same individual for a love potion or a tincture to cure your gout that you would go to, let's say, give your ex-boyfriend a brain aneurysm?
Yeah, there is definitely some moral ambiguity with witches. No, yeah, I believe it would be the same person.
Right, so there wouldn't be like a specific brujo for curses versus... You wouldn't have a good witch and a bad witch, right? This isn't a Wizard of Oz situation.
Yeah, exactly. You might have multiple brujas or brujos in the area who, you know, maybe, you know, this person does really well with midwifery and tinctures and stuff like that. And maybe this other person does really well with, like, love spells and curses and things like that. But it definitely depends on how big the community is. So you would probably have more than one brujo in the different neighborhoods of Tijuana, for example, or Mexico City. Maybe in, like, smaller towns like Laredo, you'd only have one curandero.
So... That gives us, like, their definitions and everything, mm-hmm. and what functions they serve in the communities, right? But do we have any available information on, like, socio-political importance or anything like that?
Yeah, so back in the European colonial era, it was used as a way to fight back against European colonialism. It fought against acculturation. By holding on to this part of their indigenous heritage, they were able to integrate it with their new Catholic ideas of society and make it into something new. No matter how hard the Europeans tried to stomp out witchcraft, there are always witches that pop up and help the community in ways that maybe religion can't.
It's a way for the traditionalist religious culture to sort of persist and adapt under assault.
Yeah, exactly.
What about pop culture, right? I mentioned earlier that most of what I knew came from True Blood. This character named Jesus. They get into brujeria in a really strange way. And then from the Paranormal Activity franchise, I believe it's like the fifth movie involves a couple of Mexican-American teenagers who are beset by a coven.
Mm-hmm. As ever, I can't say for certain, but I imagine there was an episode of Supernatural that focused on Mexican-American witches.
17 seasons, there's gotta be, right?
Yeah, there's gotta be. I'm trying to think of any other pop culture references. I'm sure there are plenty. I imagine in the La Llorona movies, there are probably brujos or brujas that try to help fight against her. Yeah, off the top of my head, I can't really pinpoint anything.
I found a couple of movies that look halfway interesting. There is The Old Ways, came out in 2020. It is available on Netflix, directed by Christopher Allende. It seems to be an actual, like, Mexican production. Deep in the Veracruz jungle, Mexican-American journalist Christina Lopez is held captive by a mysterious bruja who is convinced she's possessed by a demon. Then, I can vouch for having seen this one. There's a movie called Beelzebub on Shudder. It's, again, a Mexican film that entangles the border and humanitarian crisis of U.S. immigration policy and entwines that with brujeria.
Mm-hmm.
The final plot involves something like people being cursed to commit violent mass atrocities to spark, like, social chaos in protest of the border, something along those lines. It's quite a good film. And then I guess the last one that comes to mind would be Tigers Are Not Afraid.
I still need to watch that.
Tigers Are Not Afraid by Issa Lopez is quite good. And Issa Lopez is actually one of the people that I learned from about how prevalent the practice of brujeria is in Mexican and Mexican-American culture. And her appearance on the King Cast, which is a podcast focused on Stephen King movies. Excellent podcasts. Our listeners, few though they are, should check it out. She mentions to the host, she says specifically, every Mexican has either paid to curse someone or has been cursed by someone who has paid to do it. Mm-hmm. She says that it's that level of common. But her film, Tigers Are Not Afraid, I don't quite know if you would classify it as a brujeria movie. I kind of do, because the inciting incident is a little bit of magic that is imparted to a child by a woman who's the child's school teacher. The school teacher actually gives the kid like a little bit of magic, and that's the inciting incident for how the rest of the movie plays out.
Awesome. And in books, I have in front of me a copy of American Brujeria, a Modern Mexican-American Folk Magic by J. Allen Cross. And that's where I got some of my research from, particularly on the curanderos. It's a pretty good book. Goes into a lot of items that are used for witchcraft, how to work with the saints, how to work with Santa Muerte, who is Saint Death. She's not a canonized saint, but she's a relatively common figure in Mexico and Mexican America due to the amount of drug cartels and violence that is being perpetuated against them. People have started worshiping the Holy Death.
All right, then. If we pivot over to Nordic, specifically, I guess, Viking Age witchcraft, what are the similarities and differences here?
The similarities are that witches played a very specific role in the culture. They were often healers. They often worked luck magic. They often didn't so much mess around with fate as they did read fate. Viking era Nordic cultures believed that fate was set in weaving. It was a woven tapestry, and everybody had their life thread, and their life thread was meant to be cut at a specific time, and it would happen no earlier or no later than that. Sæðir, the feminine form of witchcraft, could be used to see along those lines of fate and do a little bit of fortune telling.
It's almost like the Greek mythological fate sisters.
Yeah, almost like that. Sæðir specifically is oddly associated with Odin, and it was taught to the Æsir by Freya, so you're not wrong in that. Freya is associated with witchcraft.
I'll be honest with you, I'm shocked as hell that I had that one right.
But yeah, like I was saying, Sæðir is considered a feminine magic. Masculine participation was considered to be ergi, which ergi is one of the worst insults you can throw at someone. It means you're a coward, you're weak, and it, in modern English, it's basically equivalent to the F slur used against gay people.
Sure.
And divining the future was part of what made it unmanly, because men are supposed to face their future knowing that they will die when they're meant to and not a moment before. So there's no fear. There's no anxiety about dying. There's knowing that it's going to happen and knowing that it's going to happen when it's meant to happen. And you can't change that.
Composure in the face of certain death.
Yeah.
All right, clarifying question then. Okay, what in the gender norms makes it acceptable for a feminine person? What is the feminine expectation, and is engaging in this activity, like, I almost said sinful, but that wouldn't be the correct word, right? Would that be a social transgression to do this as a woman, or would it be something that was expected / revered?
It would definitely be something that's more expected / revered. You would go to a Sæðir kona, a Sæðir woman, for different things. Like maybe a woman would go to a Sæðir kona to find out whether or not the marriage that she's being entered into would be a good fit, or find out how to best take care of the livestock and things like that, and also how to make someone sick that you don't like, inflicting misfortune upon others. So if you think somebody has cursed you and you're having a bad harvest, or your cows are getting sick or something like that, you would go to a Seder Kona to maybe introduce sickness into someone else's livestock, the person who you think is envious of you and causing yours to wane.
Similar question to what we talked about in the Mesoamerican side. If the Mesoamerican magic tradition comes from a combination mingling of indigenous religious and cultural traditions, and then the Catholic influence during the colonial era, where then does this Nordic tradition come from? Where's the power come from? Is it elemental? Is it religious? Is it earth-based?
It's very religious. It can be seen as part of worship of the gods, particularly of Freya or Odin.
So then, are there major mythological or religious figures then that a practitioner would evoke?
Yes.
Who would you evoke if you were a Viking Age witch?
You would evoke either Freya or Odin. So men did practice Sæðir, and they usually did it in secret, because part of the Sæðir magic is you need to dress up in a certain outfit in order to, like, get into the real power of it. And that outfit is generally considered a feminine outfit. It, you know, it might be some kind of, like, tunic and skirt or something like that. We don't have, like, great textile records from the Viking Age, so it's hard to pinpoint exactly what it could be, but we know it is a feminine outfit. And so men would be considered ergi if they were to dress up in women's clothes. That was actually a grounds for divorce in Viking culture. If your husband put on women's clothes, you could just, you know, point at him and say, "Hey, I'm divorcing him for wearing women's clothes." And as long as there were two witnesses, then you were divorced.
Sure.
So, Sæðir men tended to practice this in secret.
If we move from there, then, if Mesoamerican witches are associated with owls and with explaining cognitive dissonance and love potions and healing, then what type of general activities then would you expect from Sæðirs, right? Do they also engage in healing activities, or do they just tell the future and inflict various maladies?
They also deal with healing ailments and breaking curses and things like that. They're also known for being able to speak with spirits and talk with the dead. That's one of the ways that you do some of the fortune telling, is you divine the future from those that have passed and have maybe been able to see more of the web of fate than others have. And maybe they can explain, like, "Oh yeah, I didn't die from natural causes or die during an accident. I was actually murdered. And you need to take revenge upon those who have murdered me, or else I will not rest." And there's also a second type of Nordic magic called Galdrar, or Ljóð, and it involves shape-shifting, ethereal travel as an animal as the physical body remains still, controls fire, wind, and water, and also talks with the dead, but particularly those who have been hanged or those who are resting in their graves. And shape-shifting is something that also has to do with Odin. You might have heard of berserkers. They are thought to shapeshift into bears. Berserker literally translates to bear shirt.
Okay.
And when you get this blessing from Odin, you can either choose to be immune to steel or be immune to fire. And that is like a great boon for you when you're on the battlefields, particularly if you're immune to steel.
So between those two types, then, the second type, Gjaldr, if I'm saying that right, Does that also have the gender norm connotations that it's a feminine activity and for a masculine person to engage in it would be shameful or taboo?
No, this is the magic that is not shameful for men to participate in. Men are known to be hunters as well as farmers, warriors as well as husbands and fathers, things like that, and shape-shifting, particularly in the cult of the berserker. I forget the other term, but there's another cult of the wolf that is also associated with Odin. And instead of shape-shifting into a bear, you shape-shift into a wolf.
So this discussion's been really history-centered, right?
Yes.
Do these traditions persist into modern day in those areas?
Not to my knowledge, or at least not in the places in Norway that I have been to, or the Norwegian history that I have read up on. They still believe in little things, like little house spirits, like the tomte or the nisse, and they still believe in like little fairies and things like that. But the magic and having magic done for you might only be a thing that's still popular out in rural areas where there's less hustle and bustle of the city and more needing to rely on nature to bring your livelihood to fruition. I do know that there has been a resurgence in trying to bring back the pre-Christianized faith in the Viking era. That's why there's so many books on Nordic magic that you can find that aren't texts. I've got a few on my bookshelf that explain how to practice some Nordic magic and how to invoke the gods and things like that. But I don't know that there is a big demand for witchcraft like there would have been in the Nordic Viking Age. So yeah, this is much more of a historical thing than continuing into modern day.
All right. What about pop culture for the Norwegian and Nordic witches? What are some of the big things?
I would be surprised if they did not get into any witchcraft in the Vikings TV show. I have not watched it. I have heard if you come at it from a historical perspective, it's not very good.
Oh, there's no, it's on the History Channel, right? There's no way it approaches anything from like even a remotely historical vantage point. There's no way.
Yeah, exactly. I have heard it does not tell the saga of Ragnar Lothbrok very well, because that's, I believe what it's based on is the saga of Ragnar Lothbrok, which is a famous Viking warrior who sacked France and won Normandy for the Vikings.
Sure.
But he was also murdered in a pit of snakes by, I can't remember if it was the British or if it was the French. And then his sons came and avenged him.
The main thing I hear from this show is that it's one of the best instances of disability representation in, like, action fantasy.
Oh.
Because I knew of the character's name beforehand, and I've seen clips from it because I watch YouTube videos occasionally about disability representation in popular media. Ivar the Boneless, famous Viking nobility figure. I have no idea if this is accurate or not. In the show, Ivar the Boneless is depicted as a young male in the Viking royal family who does not have use of the lower half of his body. And despite this, he's still a skilled military tactician and warrior. There are a bunch of actually really, really good choreographed fight sequences of him engaging in sword fights, like from the ground.
Nice.
That are really, really well choreographed. As a fight choreographer, you have to be really creative if your fighter can't stand.
Yeah.
I have no idea if in real life, if Ivar the Boneless did not have use of his legs. No clue.
I don't know that we know that either. It would be really hard to tell from just like skeletal structures unless there is some kind of deformity in the bones themselves. But it would also be really hard to tell if this grave is in fact Ivar the Boneless. My old Norse professor, Jackson Crawford, you can find him on YouTube as Jackson Crawford. He had floated the idea to our class once that it was entirely possible that Ivar the Boneless could have been a joke about him having erectile dysfunction, because human humor has not changed in any of the time that we've been alive.
Sure. We made it 8 episodes before making a dick joke on this podcast. I want to commend us.
Very proud of us.
So there's one. We've got Vikings. Freya appears in that God of War game.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be God of War 5, where they pivot to Nordic mythology instead of Greek mythology. I know Freya, I think, is a side character, and I think she's depicted in that as like a healer goddess type.
Yeah, that's not far off from how one would depict Freya. There's also magic that's being used in Assassin's Creed Valhalla. You go to the Sather Kona, and she gives you potions that allow you to travel into Odin's body and go through some of the myths that they have in there. So that was really interesting.
So, sidebar that's still related, how well does AC Valhalla handle Nordic folklore? Because that's after the point where Assassin's Creed goes full fantasy. It's always been a little bit sci-fi, but mm-hmm. like the early games had this real obsession with like historical accuracy and stuff like that, as they would claim it, right? And then at some point we got to a point where you're fighting sphinxes in Egypt, and you're fighting griffins and giants in Assassin's Creed Odyssey. So does Valhalla get that right as it pivots to the folklore and the mythology?
It has been a minute since I have played the Aesir storylines in Assassin's Creed Valhalla, but from what I remember, they took a little bit of liberties with some of the creative aspects of the myths, but they did not stray too terribly far from them. There was a fight with Fenrir. There was a fight with Fenrir between Fenrir and Odin when you chained Fenrir up and Tyr loses his arm.
Fenrir is the wolf god?
Yes, the wolf god. Okay. One of Loki's children. What else was there? I believe it was Surt? I don't remember. It's been a while since I have played through that storyline. I should probably finish that storyline at some point, because I did not finish the Aesir storyline, even though I beat the game. But yeah, they definitely took some creative liberties, and one of my biggest complaints with the Assassin's Creed Valhalla game is they have poetry fights, which is definitely something that happened in...
I've heard of this, like freestyle rap battles, yeah.
Yes, Vikings would be all about freestyle rap battles. They would think It was just so cool. Because they did that. They did freestyle poetry battles. It was considered a very manly thing to be able to spout poetry in the middle of a battlefield. But they do, in Assassin's Creed Valhalla, they do it based off of rhymes, which is not how it would have been done in the Nordic Viking Age. Their poetry was based off of alliteration, mainly because the way that the language works does not lend itself very well to rhyming. So you have certain endings to words that will denote whether it's masculine or feminine or a verb or a noun, and there's just not really a good way to make rhyming happen in the Old Norse.
I know about the poetry battles during feasts and stuff from Barbarian Lord, mm-hmm. which is a 2014 comic book written and illustrated by Matt Smith. We did an episode of one of the other podcasts I'm on, Near Mint Condition. We did an episode on that where we had one of Matt's friends who's also a comic book writer who is very interested in various mythologies and historical stuff, including the Viking period. This book actually depicts these freestyle rap battles between the different Viking warriors. Really tremendous book. It's very, very cartoony. It's almost like a deconstruction of the Nordic hero saga genre if you did it from the point of view of like a Far Side comic strip. Does that make sense?
Okay, I have to look this up now.
It's worth checking out 100% by Barry and Lord, by Matt Smith. You can read it on Comixology, or you can find a copy at any local comic book shop. It's quite a popular comic book. It's very short, but yeah, it's actually an educated, informed deconstruction of those sagas, and it includes a bunch of the tropes and everything. It's very funny. It's got a very dry sense of humor, and it talks about like the stoicism that's expected. Two movies / book come to mind. One is an old 1920s silent movie. I do not know what country it came from or who the director even was, but it's an old 20s silent movie. It was made in Scandinavia. It's a horror film from that region, and it's about the history of witchcraft. And I think the premise is it's a documentary, but it has a bunch of like dramatic reenactment of like satanic witch rituals and stuff. The movie was originally banned in the U.S. because it's almost to the level of being a snuff film. I think people at the time believed it was a snuff film. It wasn't, but it was one of those. It's called, I want to make sure I pronounce this right, Haxan, but yeah, the A has a little circle above it. I don't know how you pronounce that.
Haxan. Yeah.
That movie is super famous as like an extreme banned film. It's up there with like Cannibal Holocaust as like a movie that was banned. And then the next one that comes to mind is a really good Netflix movie made from a pretty good book by Adam Neville called The Ritual.
Oh, okay. I have seen both of these movies.
All right, see, I have not seen Hexen. I haven't seen that one.
When I was at UCLA, part of my degree was Nordic Film Studies.
Oh, so you watched it?
Yeah, so I watched Hexen. I believe it's a Danish film.
Danish, okay.
Yeah, it's either Danish or Swedish. I don't think it's Norwegian.
Ritual, the film, focuses less on witchcraft than the book does.
Yeah.
The movie is about some type of lesser god hunting these backpackers who are hiking. I believe they're hiking in Norway.
I believe that's right.
And they are being chased by some sort of lesser Nordic god that it is eventually explained to them as a bastard child of Loki. This creature has a, like, mutually beneficial relationship with a local community of what are clearly, like, witchcraft practitioners.
Yeah.
They live, like, a traditional lifestyle with traditional Scandinavian peasant garb, and they clearly, like, you see them practicing witchcraft, although the leader of the little cult is some type of cryptid herself, and I don't know enough about Nordic folklore to know. She's a little old woman with, like, healing powers, but she has cloven feet.
Oh, she would probably just be a troll. A troll woman.
A troll of some type?
Yeah.
Okay. And then in the attic, they have, like, the dead bodies of their ancestors, which are composing, but decomposing, but still living, and they perform chants and rituals to, like, summon and then strengthen this deity. Now in the book leans less away from the monster side and more towards these backpackers are being hunted by a group of teenagers who are trying to become famous as a death metal band, and they believe to do this they have to commit like a blood sacrifice to entice like the ancient Norse demons. And I think the existence of the monster is more ambiguous in the book than it is. In the movie, the monster is really, really fucking cool. In the book, I don't think you ever even get a description of the monster or confirmation that the monster is in fact real. It's way more about these creepy teens trying to like stumble their way through ancient Nordic magic that they've half read on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that brings me to the last part I was going to think of, which is like the place I would have learned the most about this would have been through the Nordic black metal movement. I'm a fan of several metal bands, though I don't know. I know if you talk to a metalhead, they get really, really specific about their genres and subgenres, and hell, every individual band is a subgenre in and of themselves, right?
Yeah.
And I know that these groups cause like a lot of moral panic. They cause like their own little mini satanic panic.
Yeah.
In the late 90s, early 2000s, like burning down churches and stuff like that. And correct me if I'm wrong, Loki, I think there's a lot of crossover there with like the white nationalist movement, right? I know a lot of Nordic music and a lot of Nordic imagery gets co-opted by the broader European and American white nationalist movement. Like today, anytime I see a Nordic rune tattooed on someone, I'm immediately a little bit suspicious, right? Yeah. Though I have friends who have Nordic rune tattoos who are not white supremacists, that aesthetic has been co-opted so much that it makes me really wary, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that comes to mind is like Viking TikTok, people who claim to be Norse pagans on TikTok. I understand there are quite a few people who follow the Norse pagan religious tradition or whatever and are not white supremacists, but it has been so co-opted by that movement that anytime I see one of those TikToks, I'm immediately like on guard, you know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah, exactly. It has definitely been heavily co-opted by Nazis and other white nationalists, but I don't know specifically if the black metal movement in Norway was part of that. If I'm recalling correctly, the black metal movement in Norway was very much a backlash against the heavy Christianization of the country. They used to be a very specifically Christian nation, and now they have made their way into a pretty secular nation, but they still have a bunch of Christian holidays off because they enjoy taking time off of work, which who doesn't, honestly?
I just checked in while we were having this conversation to make sure I was being as accurate as possible. I'm texting a friend of mine who is an amateur historian mm-hmm. of Scandinavian black metal, as well as an expert on all of these subgenres, and he is telling me that Nazi black metal is a specific subgenre that just got mega popular among American Nazis.
Okay.
And then kind of proliferated on social media and gave the sort of impression that a lot of the movement was Nazi-based, when in reality it's one of the 9,000 subgenres of black metal.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And yeah, as someone with a rune tattoo, I take big offense at Nazis with rune tattoos because fuck you for co-opting my faith.
Oh yeah, so the first time I ever really encountered this was in a high school Spanish class. Our producer Alex will probably remember this. In our high school Spanish class, we were asked to design a restaurant menu in Spanish because the section was on food or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why, I decided, hey, it'd be pretty cool to do like a Viking theme restaurant. So I went on the good old Google machine and I found some vaguely Nordic looking runes and I drew those on my menu for the Spanish project and turned them in. And our Spanish teacher freaked his shit out.
Yeah.
Because he came to me and he was like, Lee, do you know what this means? And I was like, yeah, it's some like Viking religious calendar that I copied off of Google. And he was like, Lee, this is fucking Nazi shit. Do you understand? And I was like, what are you talking about? That's not Nazi shit. That's like some Viking thing that came off of a warship. And he was like, no, Lee, Nazis get this shit tattooed on them so they can identify each other in prison.
Yeah.
As always, Nazis ruining
everything.
Everything.
Yep.
All right. So that's anthropology, history, and pop culture on Nordic and Mesoamerican witchcraft and its practice thereof. You gave a couple of recommendations of good books you had for the Mesoamerican brujeria side.
Yeah.
You got anything good for the Nordic side for our listeners that you can recommend?
I do. Where I pulled most of my research for the Viking Age Nordic witchcraft was from this book by Stephen A. Mitchell, which is called Witchcraft and Magic in the Nordic Middle Ages. And this other book by Neil Price called The Viking Way, Magic and Mind in the Late Iron Age Scandinavia. Those are the two places that I pulled most of my research from. If you are looking for some good books on how to practice Nordic magic, I have quite a few of those. One is called Exploring the Northern Tradition by Galina Krasikova. And another one is by Freya Aswin, which is called Runes and the Feminine Powers, Northern Mysteries and Magic. I also have a book that is just called Runes, and it's by Galina Krasikova. I also have a book called Year of Viking Rituals by Scott Monkern. And if you are into poetry, I have a couple of devotionals to Loki, one of which is called Trickster, My Beloved, Poems for Laufey's Son by Elizabeth Vongvisit. I hope I said her last name right. And the other one is by Galina Krasikova, and it's called Feeding the Flame, a devotional to Loki and his family. So it's got some devotionals straight to Loki. It's got some devotionals to his wife, Sigyn.
We'll come back around to this. We're going to eventually have to get to a point where we do an entire episode on Loki.
Yeah, but yeah, those are the books that I've got.
Is there anything else that you would impart to our listeners before we call it?
Not off the top of my head. Don't go cursing people.
Yeah, avoid cursing people. Unless, you know, they're Nazis.
Exactly. Curse Nazis all you want.
If we can get all the Nazis to have a nice bout of bloody diarrhea for the next, let's say, 7 years.
Yeah.
Next week, we will put these traditions into conversation with, well, I say next week, it will be next week for us, dear listeners, but for y'all it'll be the following month with our release schedule as it is right now. We'll be putting Mesoamerican and Nordic witchcraft and magic practitioning into conversation with the Appalachian and Slavic traditions.
Looking forward to it.
As always, dear listeners, stay spooky, like, subscribe, rate 5 stars on whatever app it is you use to listen to us, and be careful out there.
Bye. Thanks so much for listening. If you want to support us, you can make a one-time donation on Acast using the Acast supporter feature, or you can make a monthly donation at ko-fi.com/luckilycryptids, all one word.
We'd also appreciate if you could follow the show on Twitter at luckilycryptids, all one word.
Podcast is edited by Alex Wimmer, who also composed the theme song. You can find them on Twitter or Bandcamp at WokeUpFuzzy, all one word.
Our logo art is by Extinct Inks, and you can find their work at extinctinks.net.
This podcast is transcribed by R.B. Lemoyne. You can find him on Twitter at R.B. Lemoyne.
And you can find Lee on Twitter at InkNerd, I-N-K-T Nerd, all one word.
You can find Loki Thursdays through Saturdays at twitch.tv/DesertTrashOpossum, all one word. Or on Twitter as Desert Trash Poss, 2 S's, all one word.